Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That, my friends, was the voice of Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly. Every week, we try to live up to his high standards of hosting a discussion of current events laced with empathy, intelligence, humor, and progressive persuasion. Although Brian's concept was less is more, more or less, in reality, you could never really have enough of Brian's magic in your life. Around the Zoom info space today, August 16th, from Voice of Vachon this week, are some old hands that you know well. Historian, guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Hallman, skipper of the Vachona, president of the Vachon Heritage Museum. Welcome back, Bruce, from your guardian of the galaxy duties last week. You were away, and rumor has it you were at an undisclosed location known as Mar-a-Lago. What galaxy-saving challenges did you face there?
Well, that's only a rumor. And the most significant challenge was actually scraping the ketchup off the wall so I could find the lock that was securing the door where the documents are stored. But once we got that done, it was all downhill from there, right?
We know sometimes you have to bring in the high powered capabilities that you certainly do possess. Welcome, glad you're here. We also have former airline pilot, treetop landing aficionado, and West Texas devotee, Truman O'Brien. Are the post-surgical miracles in your immediate future there, Truman, or maybe something else?
Well, we hope so. We hope so. Yeah, this is day five post-operation, and I was supposed to have less pain by now, but that's so far is not the case. So I've got a few drugs on board, so if I'm a little goofy, how would you tell? You know, I may be a little out of it, but I am in my pajamas. Nobody can see me but me. So.
Okay, well, and us on Zoom.
But indeed.
Yeah, so we've never ruled out Goofy, and I'm not planning to rule out Goofy today. So let her rip, I'd say.
Perfect.
And now Truman's normally, you know, behind the big board there pushing the buttons. But today, a tip of the hat to our engineer this week, Robert Stolk, who's been billed as a silent supporter. But Robert, jump right in if you feel compelled, please.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Good to hear your voice. And this week, our special small talk guest is the always insightful and professional Washington State Indivisible podcast founder and creator, not to mention a musician in his own right, Stephen Cox. It seems quite appropriate that, Stephen, your goal of informing and inspiring the Washington State progressive community should coincide with these exciting and often challenging times in our lives. Welcome, and we hope you will share a recent highlight or two of yours. How's your week been going? And you do have mute on.
You're muted.
My God. So here's the thing. When I wake up in the morning, the reason why I generally don't book morning interviews, Kevin, with the program that we do is that I tend to be a little verklempt, a little congested in the morning. And so I was clearing my throat. So I apologize for muting the mic. You asked how the last couple of weeks have been. I will say two things. One, on a personal note, it was my birthday on Saturday. And I say this not to elicit wishes of happy birthday, but rather to just note that I think I might have turned a corner as a human being in his middle age, which is at 54, I am now celebrating each one, and I would like many, many more. So that has been a sea change for me. And then on a non-personal note, I do feel like, and you're alluding to this, that Democratic politics have, I think, very much turned a corner. The Inflation Reduction Act passed, and other good developments, and a certain somebody is sweating it down in Florida. So a good couple weeks all in all, I think.
It is hot and humid in Florida, but also, you know, the long arm of the law seems to be reaching out. So, hey, just in case you've missed it, mine is the voice of Kevin Jones, Indivisible Vachon, and the Vachon Climate Action Group, who collectively, those two groups, strive to create a livable planet overseen by a government that we can all appreciate or at least tolerate. And Stefan, why don't we lead off with that whole the Inflation Reduction Act? And I would have to bring up a news feed to see whether or not it is being signed at the moment as we speak, but certainly within the next hour or two. You know, we've talked about climate on this program, and wow, it makes some pretty substantial advances in that. Does anybody want to comment on what they like best about the Inflation Reduction Act? Stefan, I'll invite you to go first if you'd like to dive in.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that that it does that I think is so profound, and this is, you know, and it's a laundry list. There are so many things that this does on the climate that it's hard to overstate, really. This is a historic piece of legislation. One thing that I think is going to provide potentially real relief in the immediate to, or at least in the near future to Americans, is allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices. This is something that has been on Democrats' wish list for many, many years, I think about a decade at this point or more. So this, I think, is an enormous step forward. I cannot still quite get a bead on what it was that incentivized Joe Manchin to come off of the almost heaven and get on board with this. And same thing with Kyrsten Sinema. It must have been an outfit of hers that inspired her that day, but I'm glad that they did. And feeling, like I said, I'm feeling very, very, very good about all this. Yeah.
All right. Anybody else want to jump in with their fan faves for the portion of the Inflation Reduction Act that they're most looking forward to?
Well, this is Bruce Holman. One of the things I think is it's monumental legislation. I mean, it is a laundry list of things, but so was the Social Security Act in the 1930s. I mean, Social Security we tend to think of just as Social Security, but it had all kinds of things about helping indigent people, helping children, helping single mothers. I mean, medical care, it began to create the Medicare system we have. I mean, there was a whole bunch of things included within that general legislation that helped to create the modern sort of state that we have today of government responsibility for individual citizens and the welfare of individual citizens. Sort of that clarion call of the Declaration of Independence, which had been ignored, for a century and a half, and all of a sudden it becomes a reality. And I think what we see in this legislation is a similar kind of list of things that are going to have tremendous impact on individual people's lives. And it's going to be as significant as Social Security was in the 1930s. I mean, there'll be pushback. There was huge pushback against Roosevelt and Social Security in the 1930s. And of course, Republicans from the 1950s on have been trying to chip away at it, even to the point of today, recently talking about eliminating Social Security. But the reality is it's a fundamental part of American society and a fundamental part of the way government and citizens interrelate. And I think this bill has similar kind of import.
Fantastic. Well, I myself, I'm looking forward to the fact that the financial incentives for electric vehicles and electric appliances are very well represented in this legislation. And the notion that that can be transformative as the transportation industry is such a big portion of our energy policy. Let's see, before we dive into small talk, let's make sure to do hear a little bit more from our guest. Truman, speaking of solar panels, I'm wondering if the solar panels on the hangars at the Vashon Airport are generating a little sizzle now during these hot days of August, maybe you've been focused on other things.
My back, thank you. But we found out that the energy buyback system that PSE had actually expired at the beginning of March of this year. And so if you generate excess energy, they won't buy it back. They'll credit you with it, but they don't buy it back. And so the whole idea of going forward with the system at the airport did not make sense anymore. And the cost of putting the system in, it would take too long to recoup the benefit. So because of the small amount of energy that the airport uses. So we've basically put that on hold because of that. But if PSE gets back to where they're buying energy, then it makes tremendous sense for us to have a large solar farm there at the airport. But that's not the case anymore.
Sounds like state government can maybe help us out here. We Vashon Climate Action Groupers are pretty pretty insistently talking to PSE on a number of fronts. So maybe that's a new chapter in that book that we're writing.
I think that would be a really great benefit. I mean, if you think about it, you know, we could put in a tremendous solar farm there. I mean, we've got all of that hangar space. All of them are south facing. All of the roof lines are. So I really think it would be a benefit to the island too if we could get that developed.
All right, watch this space.
Yeah.
So hey, Bruce. Bruce, we were speculating that behind you is the image of the Virginia Five, and we know the Vashon Heritage Museum is receiving front page billing in the local paper with promise of lots of activities coming up in the next week or so. What's happening?
Sure. Well, actually, for our radio listeners, there's a photo behind me of the Vashona, which was a competitor to the Virginia Five. Looks very similar. I mean, most of those mosquito fleet boats, you know, of the 1910s and 1920s looked very similar. But Vashona was built to serve the Tacoma Burton Run, so Quartermaster Harbor. Virginia Five was built to serve the Tacoma, Seattle run up Covos Passage, but similar boats. And an interesting sort of little rabbit hole to go down is that in 1948, the last steamboat race on Puget Sound was sponsored by the Puget Sound Steamship Association, and they raced the Virginia Five against the Vashona, the last two working steamships on Puget Sound, and Vashona lost by a narrow margin, but Virginia Five won. And of course, this year is the centennial year for the Virginia Five. She was launched in March of 1922. She went into service in June of 1922, and this weekend, August 20th, the Heritage Museum is sponsoring a cruise around Vashon Island on the Virginia Five. So all the tickets for that are sold out, fortunately and unfortunately. But we're also doing for the first time a kids' cruise, from 10:30 to 12 in the morning around Blake Island. So setting up something to get kids from basically 6-7 years old up to 14-15 year old out on the Virginia Five. There'll be number of stations where they can go in the wheelhouse, into the engine room, learn about Captain Vancouver and the early exploration of Puget Sound, and learn about marine mammals. It'll be a marine mammal sort of station. So an hour-long trip, basically, just around Blake Island, but oriented toward kids. So we're hoping to build future audiences for the Virginia Five based on that. So and there are plenty of spots open for that. I think we're taking 40 kids and up to 80 parents on that trip. So wow. So if you want to get your child out on the water, it's a great time to do it. Thanks, so, Kevin.
Bruce, one quick question. It just so happens that someone asked me this morning if the mosquito fleet was steam driven, and you just answered that question with those two. But were they coal-fired or what was providing the heat?
Interesting sort of technology. I mean, most of them were early steamships by the 1910s and 20s. Some were driven by diesel or gasoline. But the original sort of fuel was firewood.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah. I mean, the Flyer, I calculated this out one time, the Flyer, which made a trip between Tacoma and Seattle twice a day, would burn somewhere around 5,000 to 6,000 cords of wood a year.
A year, wow.
So when you see photographs of early steamer docks in Puget Sound, they are lined with firewood. And much of the old growth forests in Puget Sound went up the steam, the smokestacks of the mosquito fleet. So, and then of course, coal came in, diesel fuel came in. I mean, the Virginia Five is a steamship, but her boiler is run by diesel fuel, which heats the steam, and then the steam runs the engine. But the originals were mainly fired by wood, and then coal, and then diesel or gasoline.
All right. Thank goodness we're moving away from burning up the forest. As yes. I was just out on a three-day wilderness backpacking trip in the Olympic Peninsula, and I can tell you, I'm glad those trees didn't feed the mosquito fleet. Thanks, Bruce, for that. And as we mentioned, you're the skipper of the Vashona. You're the skipper of the namesake of the Vashona you were just talking about. And your Vashona lies in Quartermaster Harbor. If folks want to get up on top of the overlook over the yacht club, you can actually take a look at her.
Thanks. Thanks, Kevin.
Hey, let's see. Before we dive into small talk, we should also let our listener know that this is Kidney Stone Awareness Month. And what I like to think of is actually Kidney Stone Avoidance Month. But the idea is that in these warmer days in August, we tend to not stay as hydrated as we should, particularly if we're out there working, you know, haying the backyard or whatever you're doing on Vashon. So drink plenty of liquids of your choice. I don't know if there's any briefly comments on kidney stones. If so, I'll pause for just a moment.
No, that was how I ended up in Spain by myself. My mother and I were going to go to Spain right after I graduated from high school. And my father developed a kidney stone at the last moment. And I said, sorry, Mom, I'm gone. I left and left her there. She eventually joined me, but that was the start of that trip.
The adventurousness of youth. That's awesome.
Indeed. Indeed.
All right. Well, let's dive into small talk. Stephen Cox, the founder and creator of the Washington State Indivisible podcast. For those who listen to the Voice of Vashon Progressive Vashon podcast show, which is tonight at 9 o'clock and every Tuesday at 9 o'clock, you know the podcast is a pinnacle of progressive talk. So, Stephen, thank you for joining us today.
It is absolutely my pleasure, Kevin, and I will just say right off the bat, it is odd and kind of a thrill to be on this side of the microphone. This rarely, rarely happens to me, and for you to be conducting the interview when it's usually the other way around is a special treat. So thank you.
It is a true role reversal that we have going on, so let's make the best of it. But I do certainly want to, and briefly, please dive in, ask Stefan anything you'd like, but sure. Let's start out by saying, Stefan, what motivated you to create the Washington State Indivisible podcast?
Well, you know, what's funny is I listened to Bruce talk, I realize that one of my main imperatives is learning. And, you know, I'm not a Washington native. I've been here for the last, I can't do math, but since 2014. So a good coming up on 8 years here. And I'm constantly wanting to learn more about this wonderful, wonderful state and region that I live in. In terms of why I started the podcast itself, I had heard about the Indivisible movement, and this was right after the Women's March in the 2016 election. A lot of people had heard about this on the Rachel Maddow show. I read the guide online. I was very, very impressed, particularly the way in which they used the tactics of the Tea Party and leveraged them in, and put it in Democratic hands in order to push our elected officials in very effective ways. So case in point, in February of 2017, I went to an Indivisible Action. This was at then 8th CD Congressman Dave Reichert's office. We were protecting him, we're pushing him rather to protect the ACA. He was a Republican member of Congress. I was not inclined to do so. And you know, the event was very, very effective. There was press. My mom was there. Hi, nice. Jan Cox. My mom, if you're watching today. And I just had the sense that this was going to be a very big force in Washington State. And so I have a broadcasting background, Kevin, as you know. And I thought it would be a good idea to start a platform to maybe connect the various groups that were forming throughout the state. It's a very large state. We have a mountain that separates us. And so the pod started out really just by interviewing various group leaders across the state, how they got involved, what they hoped to accomplish with their group. It grew and grew. And 5.5 years later and hundreds of guests later, here we are. So,
fantastic. Well, speaking of those guests, what would you say is your most either memorable or maybe the most humorous podcast guest that you've had? And what did you talk about?
You know, there's so many to choose from. I've been really, really fortunate to speak to virtually every elected Democratic official at the state and federal level, save for Governor Inslee. If you're watching, sir, we would love to make that happen. I was particularly proud, and Kevin, you played a role in this. I was particularly proud of our discussions with both Senators Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell. This is at a time when we were really working to get them to support ending the filibuster, and each of them moved slightly, but definitely, they moved their position our way during our discussion that we had during our town hall. I would say that the chair of the Washington Democrats, Tina Podlodowski, always a treat. I would be highly remiss, gang, if I did not mention that my conversations with Kevin are very much a highlight. I refer to him as the Steve Kornacki of our show. We don't know if he's wearing khaki pants. I can only assume. We also host a monthly news quiz. It's all Washington-based trivia called Sound Off. Because it was a play on words, har har. But it's fun to see elected officials kind of let their hair down. I learned that Drew Hansen is a huge Dungeons and Dragons fan, for example. Also, Secretary of State Steve Hobbs is too. So they bonded over that. But you know, I think my favorite discussion will always be with 8th CD Congresswoman, now 8th CD Congresswoman Dr. Schreier. It was her. I had the honor of having her very first media interview, and I would just say it has been fascinating to watch her evolution from somebody who was just starting out in politics to someone who's grown into a very, very effective legislator. So lots and lots to choose from, but I think those are probably my top favorites.
All right, so we can invite Bruce and Truman to ask you about any favorite politician they have in mind to see if you've talked to them if they'd like.
Sure.
I'm interested because I've been following the Kim Schreier sort of re-election campaign. Yeah. I mean, what's your take on that? How do you think, what's the outcome going to be?
So it was going to be, this is just my opinion, so take it with a dump truck full of salt, but it is my opinion that when Reagan Dunn was going to potentially be the candidate, it was going to be a much tougher race because Reagan Dunn, despite his pivot on abortion rights and against abortion rights, was still going to try to portray himself as a moderate. And that is very much in Dr. Schreier's lane. And now that we have somebody who is a MAGA Republican running as her opposition, I think, and I'm somewhat confident when I say this, I think she's going to have less of an uphill battle. We are in no, and I live in the 8th Congressional District, so we are in no way, shape, or form letting our guard down on this one. We are going to do a full court press and make absolutely sure that that we get her across the finish line. But I will just say frankly, I think I and a lot of others are less concerned about Joe Kent than I think we were about Reagan Dunn. So if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. Hey, I have another sort of follow-up to that. It's sort of like, why a podcast? I mean, it sort of seems to me, podcasts are great. I love them. Yeah. But the people who tune into podcasts are the true believers. They're already in your camp. How does a podcast reach the people who are not in your camp?
You know, but we're not, yeah,
fringe people who are moderates, but you know, don't consider themselves progressives.
So I see it as a ripple effect. We aim our programming directly at the people who are going to be on the front lines, talking to the people that you're referencing. So I haven't inclined the program to reach the independent voter largely because I don't think that I'm going to. And so the people that I know that I get are the true believers, are the people who are really strongly motivated to go out and really push for change. One of the things that we're really working very hard on right now is we're working on messaging. Because I think a lot of people are acutely aware of just how nuanced messaging is going to have to be in order to get the Democrats across the finish line in November. And so to that end, in fact, we are hosting a town hall tonight all about how to talk to voters. It's going to be the first in a series. And I would be happy, Kevin, if you have show notes or what have you, to let folks know how that they could tune into that. But just to answer your question, Bruce, ultimately, you know, we do what is called advocacy programming. It's very similar to Kevin. I've lost the term of art that you used about the programming that you do here. But ultimately, we're trying to inform and inspire our troops, essentially, to get them to go out and talk to the people and ultimately persuade the people that they need to persuade to tip elections. So that's really the role that we see ourselves playing.
Yeah, you know, I have two questions. One, I am not familiar with podcasts at all. I have been told that people think that Brown Briefly might be an excellent vehicle for a podcast, you know. Sure. And so I'm interested in from that standpoint. But I was about to say what you just said, and that is that even though you're preaching to the choir, you're giving them new insights and new ways to look at the issues and new ways to think and talk about those issues. So I think you're fulfilling your mission by doing that rather than trying to convince somebody to change their mind. So,
well, I appreciate that. And, you know, one of the things that I think we have to be very mindful of is the fact that while the middle of the road listeners aren't listening, we know for a fact that Republican campaign operatives and others are constantly listening. And we know this because certain things that candidates will say every once in a while will appear as talking points in a debate or things like that. And so having learned that fact over the last 5 years, I've become acutely, highly aware of the sorts of questions that I ask and want to make sure that I set the candidates up to be in the best possible light. Yeah. So.
Absolutely. Well, hey, Stefan, I really appreciate the fact that you could join us today and our listeners to hear from you directly about the work you do and the magic behind it and sort of some insights. You have got a few like three-letter acronyms behind your historical skill development, NPR. Can you tell us a little bit about where you cut your teeth that have now led you to this level of professionalism that you have on the podcast?
Well, so NPR was a very short stint. They've always been in my orbit. I started interning for public radio stations as early as 1993 in KCRW in Los Angeles in Santa Monica, and then up in San Francisco at KQED. I have been, but my beat was always arts and culture, right? So I've had a crash course in Washington politics over the last 5 years. I've just been a sponge. Bruce, when you were talking about maritime issues, I'm absorbing everything that you're saying. So I started out hosting an interview program on radio station KUSF in San Francisco. I was fortunate to interview many just cultural luminaries. I couldn't believe my good fortune. I got to interview Willie Nelson, nope. Chuck D of Public Enemy, David Byrne, who was just as eclectic as you would imagine. He showed up in the studio and he offered me coffee. And he said, hi, my name's Dave. I'm like, well, yes, it is. and he's like, would you like some coffee? It's from a thermos. I'm like, sure, Dave, I'll have some of your coffee from a thermos. It's just a very, very David Byrne moment. But yeah, I was also, I also had a show about tech on Talk Radio Network. And then I got called up to host a show for Public Radio International. PRI is now largely defunct. They're just sort of a figurehead at this point. And this was in New York. And after two arduous months of trying to get the show off the air, it didn't ultimately wind up airing. But as fate would have it, I was in New York for 9/11. Where I did some reports from Ground Zero for NPR. And then I started a career in voiceover. Really it had been 15 years since I had hosted a show when I started doing the podcast. But it's like riding a bike. It came back rather quickly.
Fantastic. And it certainly shows today. It's always such a pleasure to have a chance to work together with you on the podcast, as well as listen to the results. So for our listeners who want more, of course, again, tonight, 9 p.m., you already mentioned the discussion you had with Kim Schreier, and that is teed up tonight at 9 o'clock on Voice of Vashon. So tune back in to listen to that. But Stefan, how can people get in touch with all of the work that you produce?
So you can see all of our interviews on Facebook at facebook.com/indivisiblepodcast. And you can subscribe wherever you get podcasts to the Washington State Indivisible Network. And you can also go to soundcloud.com/WSIP. We are fortunate also to have some terrestrial radio distribution throughout the state. But I think it would be much easier for somebody who is listening and may not be in the radius of one of those stations to avail themselves to one of those resources.
Fantastic. Well, I know you have a lot going on. You're very, very welcome to stay with us. We're going to dive into talking about the what Bruce often claims about the squeaky wheels of justice. And finally, what is it, Bruce? They finally...
The wheels of justice grind slowly, but they do grind.
Exceedingly fine, yes.
Yes, and they ultimately get the bastards in the end.
There you go. So that's where we're shifting gears. But Stefan, any last comments you'd like to make about the podcast before we dive into that topic?
Well, I'm not going to be able to join you for that discussion, unfortunately, because I have to go back and do some more preparation for tonight's town hall. However, one of the observations that I've had recently is that Merrick Garland, our attorney general, is a very deliberative man. I think a lot of people have been extraordinarily impatient with his process right now, but I think his track record, and I only realized this after doing a little bit of research, he prosecuted Timothy McVeigh, he prosecuted the Unabomber, he prosecuted the Olympic Park bomber. When he closes his grip, and he does it very slowly, one is not easily freed from said grip. So it is my dear hope that when we see an indictment, that that will be tantamount to conviction. But fingers crossed, y'all.
Well, I'm looking forward to adding one more name to that list of luminaries that you just cited. And I will have to say that sometimes you have to go slow to go fast.
Mm.
So. Stefan, welcome. Sign off at your leisure. But
thank you, Fred. It's been a real pleasure.
Really enjoyed.
Likewise.
Thanks.
Take care. All right. Hey, so our listeners, just in case you haven't, you know, if you've been like me and out backpacking and out of the news cycle, what is going on in the Mar-a-Lago intrigue, as the story unfolds, we're actually hearing ever-varying parade of statements from the former president. But what's happening is the National Archives retrieved multiple items from the former administration that were located at Mar-a-Lago, and items that should really remain as government property in the White House. But as the former guy left, apparently multiple boxes traveled with him. They were working to retrieve them. In fact, a Trump attorney some months ago now signed a document saying there were no additional documents at Mar-a-Lago, and particularly no more classified documents. Apparently, somebody tipped off the National Archives, which, by the way, are a bunch of librarians. And so this is a notice to not mess with librarians, because they are tougher than they look. Somebody apparently tipped off the National Archives that were additional classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. And so the Federal Bureau of Investigation conducted a federally authorized search of Mar-a-Lago. And apparently 11 sets of classified documents were retrieved from Mar-a-Lago in a storage room that apparently had a padlock. And if you've ever worked in secure documents, they included top secret special compartmented information documents, which are at the very highest level of classification of our system. So maybe let's start, let's start by asking the Briefleys, of all of the different claimed rationale that we've heard from the former administration, which do you believe is either the most creative or the least believable? Bruce, maybe you want to start us off with your candidate of the craziest explanation you've heard from the former guy.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating to me. And when you read the legal scholars who are sort of commenting on this, they all come down to the conclusion that the why doesn't matter. And so what we're hearing are all the whys, you know, mm-hmm. why, you know, because I declassified it, because I didn't know it was there, because it wasn't important, you know, or because, you know, it's my document. I mean, all of those things are sort of why. And yet in legal terms, and when you read legal scholars, they're all saying, why is it relevant? What counts is the action. And the action under the Espionage Act is treasonous. Taking highly secure, documents, particularly documents related to nuclear weapons and nuclear codes, and treating them as your own and taking them out of secure locations is treasonable. And that it was interesting to hear our guests talk about Garland and Garland's sort of record as a prosecutor. I mean, it's very encouraging that Garland moves slowly. He checks every box. He builds a solid wall of bricks that's unbreakable. And that's what he's doing in this case. And I have great hope that it's going to basically come in and really lead to a conviction of the abuses that went on in the White House and under the last president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Schrodinger's treason. Have you seen this?
So you might want to repeat that, Truman. You broke up a little bit there on your audio. You might want to start over on that.
Yeah, you know about Schrodinger's cat or the Schrodinger equation, correct? Mm-hmm. Well, this is Schrodinger's treason. And it says, when you didn't take, accidentally took, innocently used, declassified, and then took, and then declassified the documents that you never took and were illicitly planted in your house by the FBI all simultaneously. So that's Schrodinger's treason. One of the things I want to talk about, classified data. As you know, I was served in the military intelligence when I was in the Army. And so we dealt with the classification system a lot, and I dealt with classified documents. I held a secret clearance, not a top secret. So the maximum classification of documents that I saw were secret. But you know, of course, confidential, and then for your eyes only. I mean, there are the other classifications. One of the things that I found interesting in that is that oftentimes it was not necessarily the information that was in that document, but it was the context in which that information was presented that was important. So not to give any excuses, but I can see where someone might say, well, that's, why is that classified? That's, you know, everybody knows about that. Well, in the way that it's in the used and the way relationships that it's pertains to is what makes it classified. And so I think we need to pay attention to that also when somebody says, well, they were just talking about, you know, I mean, like, for example, we would have a secret class and it would be Walter Cronkite, you know, when I was going through intelligence school, and we'd come out of there going, well, everybody saw that. And they would say, mm-hmm. Yeah, but they didn't see it in this context of what we're referring to here. And then mm-hmm. It was like, oh, okay, I get it. So anyway, we need to pay attention to that as well.
Yeah, and the way I see that, Truman, I really appreciate what you're saying there. It's like a problem you're trying to solve can look very challenging when you don't have it solved. But then once you have a problem solved, sometimes it's like, it seems obvious.
Yeah.
So the idea that the people who know kind of how our national security network works, some of the things you hear are like, well, geez, that should be pretty easy to figure out. But if you're on the outside, if you're trying to figure out how our national security system works, it's not really, you know, those pieces, those bricks in the wall don't always fit together very easily. And that's the challenge, I think, that that's where our classification system comes in to really protect our national interest.
Exactly.
And in this case, of course, we don't know yet, although it may be divulged, but speculation and I guess well-informed feedback that some of the documents pertain to nuclear capabilities, whether of the U.S. or others, is uncertain. Mm-hmm.
I think, to me, one of the most telling things about this whole episode is the fact that, you know, the former president is claiming that the rules don't apply to him. Mm-hmm. And there are very specific rules about how to handle classified documents. There's very specific rules and laws about how to move documents and how to store documents and what documents belong to the government and which don't belong to the government and which documents, you know, are the responsibility of the National Archives. And what this whole thing tells me is that, you know, we have an individual here who sees themselves as above the rules, above the law. You know, and that goes across the board with how this past president has sort of approached the responsibilities of the office, you know, the sacred trust that the people of the United States put in elected officials, and the sense that all of those things don't apply. And I think that's the most insidious thing that's at work here. Because if they don't apply to the president, they don't apply to anybody.
Exactly. And absolutely.
Are we going to be, it's a basic question, are we going to be a nation under the rule of law, or are we going to be a nation under the rule of arbitrary decisions by an individual? And that's the central sort of question that we're dealing with right now in America and in American democracy. And we're at the edge of losing it if the decision goes that individuals have priority over the rule of law.
Well, you know, it gets me when people say, well, if they can do that to the ex-president, they can come after you. And then the answer is, yes, they can. If you break the law, if you break those mm-hmm. things, they can come right after you. So there is no difference.
And that's exactly how it should be, in my opinion.
Exactly.
And you often hear people say that, you know, if I did that, right, if I had classified documents sitting in my house, guess what? I would fully expect that if we were caught, that I would be prosecuted for Absolutely. Violating those laws. Yeah. Exactly. And that's the way our system is built upon.
Exactly.
It's an interesting dichotomy to me that many of those individuals who are very vociferous in their support of law and order, you know, are finding themselves waffling on this case where it's a clear breaking of the law, you know, and I think Garland's inquiry and the whole sort of process that's going on, I mean, there's going to be a watertight case at the end of this. And how do you reconcile a support for law and order with the sense that, well, I'm for law and order, but not against this individual?
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of that, you know, this whole thing, while we're sort of joking around about this, it's not all fun and games, right? The FBI and the Department of Homeland Security last week issued a warning of an increase in the threats against federal law enforcement, including a general calls that they've been hearing on social media about people wanting to engage in civil war or armed rebellion. Briefly, what are your thoughts about this? We've already seen examples in Cincinnati with the nail gun attack on the FBI office. We're hearing, of course, the former administration's advocates in Congress today speaking about, again, fighting, taking back our country. Where do we think it's headed? Bruce, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, the American Civil War began when the party in power, you know, essentially was ousted by a Republican, Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, and the cascade of that sort of event ultimately led to states withdrawing from the Union, firing on federal forts, and the beginning of an armed conflict, you know, the bloodiest armed conflict in American history. Party in power has a lot to lose. And essentially, when they see themselves losing that power, you know, if you have unscrupulous individuals, they're willing to sort of do anything to hold on to that power. And that's, to me, the major threat that we confront right now is, are we going to be a democracy of law and rules and traditions? Or are we going to throw that out the window and become a democracy in name only, you know, sort of controlled by who has the most power?
Mm-hmm. So, Bruce, as a historian, do you think that there's a line, a defined line that says now we've crossed into civil war? Or is that like those problems that are hard to solve? They look difficult to solve, but it becomes clear after the fact and you look back at the solution. Do you look back and say this is the point in time where you cross the threshold? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, again, civil wars become, I mean, by the very nature of calling them wars, we're talking about armed conflict. In reality, you know, civil wars go on all the time. I mean, the 1960s was a civil war. 1960s and 70s was a type of cultural civil war in the United States. And tremendous changes came out of that. The 1930s, the Great Depression, was a form of cultural civil war. Not armed conflict, but, you know, conflict. And so yeah, it is a vague line, but once people pick up arms and start shooting at each other, then it becomes warfare.
Exactly. There you go. Well, I will just in closing say that my favorite excuse is that any document that made it from the Oval Office to the residence now is automatically declassified, including whatever the president might have used as a tea tray to bring the hamburger back to the bedroom. So that just doesn't seem to work either. I will, again, 9 o'clock tonight, Stephen Cox, our guest for Small Talk, talks with Congresswoman Kim Schreier. And next week on the Brown Briefly, Small Talk guest will be Jason Johnson of Vashon Household, who will be discussing housing access on Vashon Maury Islands. And so for Stephen, our guest, Bruce, shout out to Robert. Thanks for engineering. Truman and our compatriot who's on the road, Mr. Craig Bellis. I'm Kevin Jones. See you next Tuesday for the next edition of the Brown Briefly.